Chapter 20. Can Letty know she've waited on worse? Then she must have had more charity than sense, said Henchard. Oh no, as he hadn't. We're not for charity but for hire, and at a public house in this town. It is not true, cried Henchard indignantly. Just ask her, said Nance, folding her naked arms in such a manner that she could comfortably scratch her elbows. Henchard glanced at Elizabeth Jane, whose complexion, now pink and white from confinement, lost nearly all of the former color. What does this mean? He said to her. Anything or nothing. It is true, said Elizabeth Jane. But it was only, did you do it, or didn't you? Where was it? At the Three Mariners. One evening for a little while, when we were staying there. Nance glanced triumphantly at Henchard, and sailed into the barn, for assuming that she was to be discharged on the instant as he had resolved to make the most of her victory. Henchard, however, said nothing about discharging her. Unduly sensitive on such points by reason of his own past, he had the look of one completely ground down to the last indignity. Elizabeth followed him to the house like a culprit, but when she got inside she could not see him, nor did she see him again that day. Convinced of the scathing damage to his local repute and position that must have been caused by such a fact, though it had never before reached his own ears, Henchard showed a positive distaste for the presence of this girl not his own whenever he encountered her. He mostly dined with the farmers at the market room of one of the two chief hotels, leaving her in utter solitude. Could he have seen how she made use of those silent hours, he might have found reason to reserve his judgment on her quality. She read and took notes incessantly, mastering facts with painful laboriousness, but never flinching from her self-imposed task. She began the study of Latin, incited by the Roman characteristics of the town she lived in. If I am not well informed, it shall be by no fault of my own, she would say to herself through the tears that would occasionally glide down her peachy cheeks, when she was fairly baffled by the portentous obscurity of many of these educational works. Thus she lived on, a dumb, deep-feeling, great-eyed creature, construed by not a single contiguous being, quenching with patient fortitude her incipient interest in Farfrae, because it seemed to be one-sided, unmaidenly, and unwise. True, that for reasons best known to herself, she had, since Farfrae's dismissal, shifted her quarters from the back room affording a view of the yard which as he had occupied with such zest, to a front chamber overlooking the street. But as for the young man, whenever he passed the house he seldom, or never turned his head. Winter had almost come, and unsettled weather made her still more dependent upon indoor resources. But there were certain early winter days in Casterbridge, days of firmamental exhaustion which followed angry southwesterly tempests when, if the sun shone, the air was like velvet. She seized on these days for her periodical visits to the spot where her mother lay buried, the still-used burial ground of the old Roman British city, whose curious feature was this, its continuity as a place of sepulture. Mrs. Henchard's dust mingled with the dust of women who lay ornamented with glass hairpins and amber necklaces, and men who held in their mouths coins of Hadrian, Posthumus, and the Constantines. 10:30 in the morning was about her hour for seeking this spot, a time when the town avenues were deserted as the avenues of Karnak. Business had long since passed down them into its daily cells, and leisure had not arrived there. So Elizabeth Jane walked and read, or looked over the edge of the book to think, and thus reached the churchyard. There, approaching her mother's grave, she saw a solitary dark figure in the middle of the gravel walk. This figure, too, was reading, but not from a book. The words which engrossed it being the inscription on Mrs. Henchard's tombstone. The personage was in mourning like herself, was about her age and size, and might have been her wraith or double, but for the fact that it was a lady much more beautifully dressed than she. Indeed, comparatively indifferent as Elizabeth Jane was to dress, unless for some temporary whim or purpose, her eyes were arrested by the artistic perfection of the lady's appearance. Her gait, too, had a flexuousness about it, which seemed to avoid angularity. It was a revelation to Elizabeth that human beings could reach this stage of external development. She had never suspected it. She felt all the freshness and grace to be stolen from herself on the instant by the neighborhood of such a stranger. And this was in face of the fact that Elizabeth could now have been writ handsome, while the young lady was simply pretty. Had she been envious, she might have hated the woman, but she did not do that. She allowed herself the pleasure of feeling fascinated. She wondered where the lady had come from. The stumpy and practical walk of honest homeliness which mostly prevailed there, the two styles of dress thereabout, the simple and the mistaken, equally avouched that this figure was no Casterbridge woman's, even if a book in her hand resembling a guidebook had not also suggested it. The stranger presently moved from the tombstone of Mrs. Henchard, and vanished behind the corner of the wall. Elizabeth went to the tomb herself. Beside it were two footprints distinct in the soil, signifying that the lady had stood there a long time. She returned homeward, musing on what else he had seen, as she might have mused on a rainbow or the northern lights, a rare butterfly or a cameo. Interesting as things had been out of doors, at home it turned out to be one of her bad days. Henchard, whose 2 years mayoralty was ending, had been made aware that he was not to be chosen to fill a vacancy in the list of aldermen, and that Farfrae was likely to become one of the council. This caused the unfortunate discovery that as he had played the waiting maid in the town of which he was mayor, to rankle in his mind yet more poisonously. He had learned by personal inquiry at the time that it was to Donald Farfrae, that treacherous upstart, that as he had thus humiliated herself. And though Mrs. Stanage seemed to attach no great importance to the incident, the cheerful souls at the Three Mariners, having exhausted its aspects long ago, such was Henchard's haughty spirit that the simple thrifty deed was regarded as little less than a social catastrophe by him. Ever since the evening of his wife's arrival with her daughter, there had been something in the air which had changed his luck. That dinner at the King's Arms with his friends had been Henchard's Austerlitz. He had had his successes since, but his course had not been upward. He was not to be numbered among the aldermen, that peerage of burghers, as he had expected to be, and the consciousness of this soured him today. "Well, where have you been?" he said to her with offhand laconism. "I've been strolling in the walks and churchyard, father, till I feel quite leery." She clapped her hand to her mouth, but too late. This was just enough to incense Henchard after the other crosses of the day. "Won't have you talk like that," he thundered. "Leery, apostrophe indeed. One would think you worked upon a farm. One day I learn that you lend a hand in public houses. Then I hear you talk like a clodhopper. I'm burned. If it goes on, this house can't hold us two. The only way of getting a single pleasant thought to go to sleep upon after this was by recalling the lady as he had seen that day, and hoping she might see her again." Meanwhile, Henchard was sitting up, thinking over his jealous folly in forbidding Farfrae to pay his addresses to this girl who did not belong to him, when if he had allowed them to go on, he might not have been encumbered with her. At last he said to himself with satisfaction as he jumped up and went to the writing table, "He'll think it means peace and a marriage portion, not that I don't want my house to be troubled with her, and no portion at all." He wrote as follows: "Sir, on consideration, I don't wish to interfere with your courtship of Elizabeth Jane, if you care for her. I therefore withdraw my objection, accepting in this, that the business be not carried on in my house. Yours, M. Henchard, Mr. Farfrae." The morrow, being fairly fine, found Elizabeth Jane again in the churchyard, but while looking for the lady she was startled by the apparition of Farfrae, who passed outside the gate. He glanced up for a moment from a pocketbook in which he appeared to be making figures as he went. Whether or not he saw her, he took no notice, and disappeared. Unduly depressed by a sense of her own superfluity, she thought he probably scorned her, and quite broken in spirit sat down on a bench, She fell into painful thought on her position, which ended with her saying quite loud, "Oh, I wish I was dead with dear mother." Behind the bench was a little promenade under the wall, where people sometimes walked instead of on the gravel. The bench seemed to be touched by something. She looked round, and a face was bending over her, veiled, but still distinct, the face of the young woman as he had seen yesterday. Elizabeth Jane looked confounded for a moment, knowing she had been overheard, though there was pleasure in her confusion. "Yes, I heard you," said the lady, in a vivacious voice, answering her look. "That can't have happened?" I can't tell you," said Elizabeth, putting her hand to her face to hide a quick flush that had come. There was no movement or word for a few seconds, then the girl felt that the young lady was sitting down beside her. "I guess how it is with you," said the latter. "That was your mother." She waved her hand towards the tombstone. Elizabeth looked up at her, as if inquiring of herself whether there should be confidence. The lady's manner was so desirous, so anxious, that the girl decided there should be confidence. "She was my mother," she said, "my only friend." "But your father, Mr. Henchard, he is living?" "Yes, he is living," said Elizabeth Jane. "Is he not kind to you?" "I've no wish to complain of him." "There has been a disagreement?" "A little." "Perhaps you were to blame," suggested the stranger. "I was in many ways," sighed the meek Elizabeth. "Swept up the coals, when the servants ought to have done it, and I said I was leery, and he was angry with me." The lady seemed to warm towards her for that reply. "Oh, you know the impression your words give me?" she said ingenuously. "Hattie is a hot-tempered man, a little proud, perhaps ambitious, but not a bad man." Her anxiety not to condemn Henchard, while siding with Elizabeth, was curious. "Oh no, certainly not bad," agreed the honest girl. "And he has not even been unkind to me till lately since mother died. But it has been very much to bear, while it has lasted. All is owing to my defects, I dare say, and my defects are owing to my history." "What is your history?" Elizabeth Jane looked wistfully at her questioner. She found that her questioner was looking at her, turned her eyes down, and then seemed compelled to look back again. "My history is not gay or attractive," she said. "And yet I can tell it, if you really want to know." The lady assured her that she did want to know, whereupon Elizabeth Jane told the tale of her life as she understood it, which was in general the true one, except that the sale at the fair had no part there. Contrary to the girl's expectation, her new friend was not shocked. This cheered her, and it was not till she thought of returning to that home in which she had been treated so roughly of late, that her spirits fell. "I don't know how to return," she murmured. "Think of going away. But what can I do? Where can I go?" "Perhaps it will be better soon," said her friend gently. "So I would not go far. Now what do you think of this? I shall soon want somebody to live in my house, partly as housekeeper, partly as companion. Would you mind coming to me?" "But perhaps, oh yes," cried Elizabeth, with tears in her eyes. "Would, indeed I would do anything to be independent. For then perhaps my father might get to love me. But, ah, what? I am no accomplished person. And a companion to you must be that." "Oh, not necessarily. Not? But I can't help using rural words sometimes, when I don't mean to." "Never mind, I shall like to know them. And oh, I know I shan't do," she cried with a distressful laugh. "Accidentally learned to write round hand instead. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter."